This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm David Brooks of the Nashua Telegraph and GraniteGeek.org, sitting in for Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. One of New Hampshire's most polarizing political issues, concealed carry, is back in a big way. A Senate bill that would repeal the law requiring permits for a concealed carry firearm passed the House this week, setting the stage for a rare veto showdown with the governor. Representative John Thall of Whitfield argued in favor of the bill.
If I know that after nearly 44 years in law enforcement, the criminals do not apply for permits, and if I further believe that passing Senate Bill 116 will result in basically no change to those who decide to carry or not carry, would I now press the green button?
Meanwhile, in presidential politics, Republican Carly Fiorina made a visit to Concord, where she touted her business credentials and international experience. And she also went after the Democratic frontrunner, Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton desperately wants to run a campaign on being the first woman president. She desperately wants to run a campaign on the war on women. And I think Hillary Clinton should have to run her campaign on her own track record, or lack thereof.
And in energy news, the nation's largest residential solar panel installer announces that it is expanding to New Hampshire. Lee Kashishian of Solar City says it's not the abundance of sunshine that brings them to the Granite State.
The price of power that we're really comparing ourselves to allows us that competitive advantage, and environment that we think is going to allow us to open a place and operate for years to come.
It's our Friday News Roundup here on The Exchange. We're going to take a look at what's happened in the state over the past week with our guests, and let us hear from you, of course. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So our guests today are Kevin Landrigan, who is chief political correspondent for New Hampshire One News. Hello, Kevin.
Good morning, Dave.
And Dean Spiliotis, who's a civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Hello.
Good morning, Dave.
And Rick Stevens, Northern and New England correspondent for the Associated Press.
Morning, Dave.
So let's plunge right in, because obviously we have a lot to talk about this week. We will start out with a story that's been around for a while. Michael Addison. On Thursday, the state Supreme Court ruled to keep the death sentence for Michael Addison. And I wonder, Rick, if you could sort of quickly remind us what that's all about.
Yeah, and you're right, Dave. This has been around a while. We were talking yesterday. It's almost 10 years since Officer Briggs was killed in Manchester. Just as a little background, it was October 2006, and Addison is wanted by the Manchester PD for a string of violent crimes, including a drive-by shooting, some armed robberies. Officer Michael Briggs is about 15 minutes from the end of his shift. He's on bicycle patrol with his partner when they confront Addison in an alley in Manchester. They order him to stop. He refuses. Michael Briggs is shot and killed. Addison was convicted, sentenced to death, the state's only death row inmate. That's a bit of a misnomer. We don't really even have a death row in New Hampshire. But anyway, after a series of appeals, the last direct appeal was heard in January by the state's high court, the Supreme Court. And basically what they were looking at was whether that sentence, Addison's sentence of death, was fair when compared to other cases in which someone had been convicted of killing an on-duty police officer. Two arguments. The defense argued that the court should look at a wide variety of cases, some 300-plus cases nationwide of convicted police officer killings. the prosecution, the state argued a much narrower universe, 10 cases or 12 cases at most. The court looked at the smaller universe of cases and this week on Thursday ruled that the death sentence was in fact fair when compared to other police officer-involved killings.
Was there a surprise to that ruling, or did people expect it, or?
You know, I don't know if surprise is the right word. Both both sides, the prosecution and the defense side, they said there wasn't going to be any reason for celebration no matter which way the court ruled, that it was not about celebrating. It was about respecting the law. And they all brought it back to Briggs, to Officer Briggs and his family and the family.
Right. So Kevin, what happens next? I mean, is this it?
Yeah, well, obviously, he's got other constitutional avenues of appeal. There's certainly federal appeals that he could pursue regarding challenging the death penalty sentence itself as cruel and inhuman punishment. They could certainly try to also make the case that New Hampshire is not fully prepared to carry this out. As Rick points out, we don't have a death row right here. There have been estimates that in order to construct one and maintain one, it could cost a couple of $1 million. So that certainly is going to lengthen the time between now and when he is likely to be executed.
There's also, David, a state appeal already starting to work its way into the process. What his defense lawyer is trying to do is chip away at the foundation of factors that led to a death sentence. There are six separate convictions, and his defense lawyer this week, maybe it was late last week, filed an appeal against one of those convictions. So if you can knock out some of the idea being if you can knock out some of the base of the pyramid, the rest of it crumbles, and so does the death sentence.
So the Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty was applicable, but they're trying to say maybe that the conviction had problems.
The convictions, some of the underlying convictions.
Right.
That's right.
Okay.
Yep,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Obviously, this is an issue that a lot of people feel strongly about, as you could tell from New Hampshire Public Radio comments on some of our articles and the Facebook page. I got a couple of them here that pretty much summarize two people. So a Bill Fosher put it this following comment. He said, should the death penalty apply? He said, no. The death penalty doesn't work. It's expensive. It's barbaric. Addison should spend the rest of his life in prison. The legislature should repeal the death penalty, and Maggie Hassan should commute Addison's death sentence to life in prison without parole. Whereas Charles Wright said bluntly, yes, it's a deterrent, the death penalty. Just like the old days with hard labor, that was a deterrent. But we don't have that anymore. We're too nice to criminals. We want them to fear going to jail so they'll do the right thing. And I think those pretty much summarize the arguments that we've been hearing all along and that we will probably continue to hear in this case. All right. Let's shift to the unending story of the presidential campaign. We had a couple of new or new-ish faces in the state this week, starting with Bernie Sanders. Even the New York Times calls him Bernie now. I was happy to see. Can you talk to us a little bit about that, Dean?
Sure. And he does have one of those names that's pretty much ready for the bumper sticker. I don't actually hear anybody around here refer to him as Senator Sanders or Sanders. It's just Bernie. So he's got good name recognition, at least in the region. Yes, he has been talking about running for a while. He's now made it official. He had said that he was concerned that he would be able to raise a sufficient amount of money from small donors. He's not going to take corporate PAC money. I think realistically, to be competitive at all, he needs something in the $30 to $50 million range just to kind of make a good show in the early races. That's not an insignificant amount of money, but in comparison to what Hillary Clinton's going to raise, nowadays it seems like a pretty modest sum for a presidential race. It's interesting. I think if this were a much larger Democratic field, he would not be getting nearly as much attention as he's getting right now. But because he literally is the only other person fully in the race with Secretary Clinton, he's going to get a lot of attention, particularly because progressives have been waiting for somebody to rally around. They're not getting Elizabeth Warren. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with progressives in the state who are wringing their hands over the Clinton candidacy. They wanted somebody they can rally behind. I think people are realistic about the likelihood that he'll be the nominee or the lack of the likelihood that he'll be the nominee. But he could be very persuasive and have a big impact on the narrative and kind of pull Secretary Clinton to the left a little bit. So there is a lot of excitement to finally. I think even the press is excited because now they have some sort of competition to write about. But you know, it's going to be a tough road for him. But as I said, because it's a small field, he's going to get a level of attention and scrutiny that he would not have gotten in a much larger field, given his kind of sort of far left ideological positioning on most issues.
So, Kevin, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, Dean certainly raises some good points. I think I certainly think that a competitive Democratic primary is good for the New Hampshire Democratic Party. I really do. With this many candidates running on the Republican side, they're getting a lot of attention, a lot of free media, and very often Democrats in New Hampshire have been loath to have very competitive primaries, and sometimes it has been to their detriment. I think it could be in this race. What I'm most struck about with regard to the 2016 campaign is how many voters I find as I go around the state who really have both Clinton and Bush fatigue on both the left and the right. I think that's going to be a big narrative of this election on the Republican side. I think that's why so many Republicans are going forward at this early stage to say, I'm a new candidate, I'm a fresh candidate. And on the Democratic side, I certainly find even people who are fond of Secretary Clinton truly believe that she'll be a lightning rod in the general election campaign, that she's a polarizing figure, and they're concerned that that enough moderates would be attracted to her against an attractive Republican nominee. She'll be able to prove that in a competitive primary. Had she not had one, I think those questions would linger.
All righty. And we had one other candidate who was known to Hewlett-Packard employees, certainly. Carly Fiorina was in the state once again for 4 days, which is a lot. Dean, did she surprise anybody?
No, you know, it's actually interesting. I spoke with her about a month ago now, and even back then she seemed very likely to get into the race. She's been working very diligently at this, spending a lot of time here. She had a four-day swing this week in New Hampshire. She spent a lot of time in Iowa. She's starting, you know, it's a very crowded field. She doesn't have a political background. As you mentioned, she's the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard. And so, you know, she's got to kind of sort of fight for visibility. I think, you know, I've read some reports that she's starting to get some attention in Iowa. That may happen here as well. She's very kind of very persuasive on the stump. She's you know, my sense of talking to her, she's kind of a traditional business conservative, fairly supply side, also very hawkish on foreign policy, which is, you know, kind of a pretty sharp contrast, say, in comparison to someone like Rand Paul. So, you know, I think she's going to work really hard at it. She clearly has the political bug. It seems like she's really excited about the opportunity. You know, there's sort of interesting a gender argument. She's the only woman in the Republican field. Some people think that in some way neutralizes Hillary Clinton on the gender issue. The other thing I often hear is that, you know, there may be a need for a female VP candidate, perhaps.
Ah, interesting. Well, coming up, we got two perennial debates in the New Hampshire legislature, casino gambling and concealed carry. Let's hear your thoughts. Were you hopeful for gambling this year? Do you agree that Governor Hassan's plan to veto the concealed carry? Stay with us for more Friday. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Dave Brooks, sitting in for Laura Kanoi. We're covering some of the top stories of the week, including two big statehouse votes this week addressing casino gambling and concealed carry. Let's hear from you on this and other stories. Remember, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, and there's that email, exchange at NHPR. So the House passed Senator Jeb Bradley's bill to eliminate the permit that's currently required if you want to carry a concealed weapon in New Hampshire. There's no permit necessary to carry an unconcealed weapon. So, and the governor has said she's very likely to veto it. So, Kevin, was this a surprise?
Well, it's certainly interesting that she would come out the way she did. She choreographed this decision really well, I thought, from a political standpoint, decided to announce it in front of the New Hampshire Moms March, a group of gun control advocates who oppose getting rid of this permit. She also, her office had asked for a letter from the New Hampshire Association of Police Chiefs on the same morning, about an hour earlier, which demanded that she veto the bill. What's certainly interesting to me is to look at this from a political context, what does this really mean about her political future? Certainly for someone who would run for federal office, were she to take on Kelly Ayotte, this would be a far riskier position than if she were to run for re-election. Certainly Kelly Ayotte has already earned her sort of bona fides with the gun lobby nationally with her opposition to the background check legislation. You remember she got a lot of heat back here in New Hampshire about it. Hassan has certainly some relevant reasons to talk about a veto. The permit has been in place for 100 years. There's no age limit in this permit, as some other states that have that don't require permits. They don't allow in some states to for people under 21 to carry concealed for any reason. This also doesn't have any training requirements. Three of the five states that don't allow don't have a permit required actually do require folks to be trained about how to carry concealed, how to store their weapons, that sort of thing. That isn't in here as well. So what will be interesting to see now is if Senator Bradley and Republicans in the Senate try and, quote, improve this bill, unquote, to make it less likely that she'd veto it. I don't think they'll succeed, but they may make that attempt.
Rick?
We had a question yesterday, too, about the likelihood of a veto override. Probably not all that likely because they'd have to have, what, a handful of Democrats, a strong handful of Democrats to go over to the other side. I would just note, too, and Kevin mentioned that this is a perennial issue, not just here but everywhere. Gun rights are a big issue. Right now in Maine today, the state of Maine, they're considering a concealed carry permit.
Ban.
Vermont last week was considering changes on background checks and – how and when someone who had been deemed mentally ill would be able to get a gun license again. This is the stuff that comes up all the time, every year, and it always touches a raw nerve.
And I can show you that once again from Facebook comments that we've gotten over the week. Kelly said not only should permits be required, they should also require training. No one should be carrying a firearm without proper training. Whereas Keith responds, it's a license, not a permit. Vermont has never required a license. Vermont is the safest state in the nation, which is a compelling argument as well. And so
it is. There, even if the permits were repealed, gun advocates point out that many people in New Hampshire would continue to seek a permit in order to be able to carry a concealed weapon in 20 other states. That New Hampshire has a reciprocal agreement that basically says you can carry in those states. They have permit laws, but only if you have a New Hampshire permit. Some popular destinations like both Florida and California and New York all have permit requirements. You'd have to have a permit in New Hampshire, even if one wasn't required, in order to carry concealed there.
Okay. Well, let's go on to another perennial topic that certainly you all have talked about many times is the casinos, the idea of getting gambling into the state for money and other reasons. And the casino bill met its death in the House this week. So I'm curious, how strong was the opposition this time as compared to previous years?
Yes, well, just to remind the listeners, you know, we've had this casino debate for a number of years now. This was the Senate Bill 113, which allowed for one large casino and one small casino. And, you know, there was some concern about whether or not the state could support it economically. So the bill had a change in it that would allow for an audit of the first casino and then a one-year delay until you get the smaller license. And it was about $120 million in licensing fees for the state. You know, passed the Senate, and we're all waiting to see what the new Republican House would do. And it was defeated in the House 223 to 141 after a close 10-9 vote in favor out of committee a little bit earlier. So this is one of those things where no one was quite sure what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, casinos, the voting on casinos doesn't typically cut right along party lines. It's a little bit mixed. You know, Governor Hassan had initially said she would prefer one casino, and then she came around to saying she would support two casinos. So, you know, my sense is that the issue is dead for now, but it's probably not dead indefinitely, certainly as long as Lou D'Alessandro is in the Senate, and he's a very strong proponent of this, and he likes to bring these bills up. You know, as I've mentioned here before, and I've lived in two states over the last 30 years, where this gambling debate, it's the same thing year after year, decade after decade. I've heard every argument. The only new thing I've heard in the last year and this actually favors opponents, is the sort of economic saturation argument that you know, now Atlantic City's struggling, the Connecticut casinos are struggling, the Maine casinos are struggling. There's just too many casinos and saturation on the East Coast. Can the state really support this? The countervailing argument is that people tend to gamble close to home, so that maybe if you build them here, they'll stay here rather than go to the new casinos in Massachusetts or Connecticut. So it's the same stuff over and over again. You know, looks like we'll have to wait for another year to see what happens.
Yeah, there were some attempts in the House to try and put a free market spin on this casino debate. A number of amendments offered to allow much greater proliferation of casinos in the state. About 110 House members voted for that, not a substantial margin, but as it turned out, 75% of those folks ended up voting against this two casino bill. So many people, many supporters of casinos in the wake of this defeat, which was a substantial smackdown, are looking at the issue and wondering, in order to build more momentum, do we somehow have to try and construct legislation that would have a very large destination casino and some smaller locations spread across the state? That may be the next iteration we see next year.
Dean had mentioned competition, and he's exactly right. That's what's eating up the revenues down along the eastern seaboard. And we've got to recognize, too, that just to our south in Everett, Massachusetts, they're building a massive casino, some three times the size of the largest casino that would have been proposed here in New Hampshire. Are people from those southern populous markets, New York City, New Jersey, Boston, are they going to drive past that to get to New Hampshire? It's a question.
Right. All righty. Well, we have another issue that has not been perennial but has generated a ton of debate, certainly in Nashville particularly, where I am. We've been hearing about it for ages, and that's panhandling. That is people standing on the side of the road. And this is not coming up to you in the sidewalk, but on the side of the road, so when you drive past. And there was an attempt in Nashua to have an ordinance that would basically prevent people from stopping and giving money or giving anything to people when they were driving in the road. It was turned down. The bill was similar to one that Concord has. It was turned down, but there was a ton of debate about it. Dean, I think you know something about this.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. As you mentioned, we went through the same issue here in Concord. Anybody who knows Exit 14, where Loudoun Road and Fort Eddy Road intersect, there are typically people standing on the side of the road with signs explaining their situation and asking for financial help. And occasionally you see drivers, you know, exchange something with the individuals. And sometimes you have rear-end collisions because it sort of throws off the flow of traffic. And I know there's also been a similar issue up in the Upper Valley at where 12A hits Interstate 89 and now in Nashua. So you have these big intersections where you have this problem, and it's the police view it as dangerous to people getting injured and flow of traffic. So, you know, you have to be careful with this issue because there is a First Amendment right to free speech. And Concord had to figure out how to sort of make it safe without infringing on free speech rights. So what they came up with was this idea that, you know, you can stand on the side of the road with a sign, but any exchange of material between drivers and individuals outside the cars would be subject to a fine. And I guess Nashua was considering a similar item, and they tabled it 8-6, I believe.
So part of the argument, which was really interesting in Nashua, was the firefighters who were concerned that it would pretty much end what they call their boot drive, not just in Nashua, where they raise money and ask you to put it into a boot, and they stand by the side road and get it. And it's one of their major money raisers over the years. And so they were very much concerned that this would kill that. And that was, I believe, one of the major factors in having it tabled.
Yeah, certainly in Concord, many city officials believe that the panhandling proliferation in the capital city was driven by people interested in raising money for drugs. What police found when they did a lot of surveillance of the panhandling that occurred not just around Fort Eddy Road but in other places in the state, that there were actually these small gangs of people that would go from location to location. A white panel truck would drive up, three guys would get out, three guys would get in, that there were these shifts of people that were raising this money. And certainly it's the same concern that is occurring in Manchester and why Mayor Ted Gatsis is supporting a ban on panhandling. because he says it's creating a real problem in the downtown. As you know, on Elm Street, there are a lot of restaurants. There's a Verizon Center. It's got probably the most active nightlife of any city in the state. And Mayor Gatsas feels that people are being harassed too much by these folks.
I think there certainly is a feeling. It certainly came up in Nashua. A lot of people who would support, you know, the idea of helping the homeless and helping people who need jobs, who were feeling that this surge in panhandling was so great and so relatively sudden that it did seem organized and therefore maybe not really worthy of support or less worthy of support than might be. That, I think, that's definitely seemed to undermine some of the debate. There was also concern that the proposed ordinance would do nothing about what was called aggressive in-your-face panhandling. So the guy's coming up to you in the sidewalk, perhaps, did not address that at all. So that was another reason for it to be shot down. Do you think this issue is gonna keep coming up, or do you think maybe that it sort of had its time and it's gonna pass away? Any thoughts on that?
Well, it feels to me, I mean, as Kevin points out, Manchester's now wrestling with it. It feels to me like it'll be there as long as there's going to be this population.
Yeah, and certainly you have a lot of advocates for the poor, for homeless, for low-income housing. Many of them have been outspoken that that this kind of proliferation of panhandling is giving the impression that it is poor people badgering the public for money, and those folks don't represent their clients. And that's why you're seeing even advocates for the poor in Manchester supporting this idea.
They're afraid it's giving them a bad name, making it harder for them to raise money
exactly.
and get help. Exactly.
Yeah,
that makes sense. So I agree. Certainly, from the amount of debate it produced in Nashua, I do not think this issue is going away at all. So we have a couple minutes before the break. So let's turn to a slightly lighter topic that actually, as you know, Senator Shaheen was in Nashua this week and talking to some, I believe they were fourth graders, about her desire to see a woman put on the $20 bill. Obviously, there are no women on any of our currency at the moment. And this is an issue that's suddenly gotten a surprising amount of attention. Rick, do you know much about this? Or?
Yeah. Holly Raymer in the AP Bureau here in Concord wrote about this a week or so ago. We had to look. I'm a journalist, so I don't get many 20s in my wallet. So we had to I had to remind myself who was on it. Andrew Jackson, of course, has been on there since 1928. There was a woman on a currency note. It was Martha Washington, and it was back in 1886 was the first time she appeared on a currency note that was a silver certificate. But no woman has ever appeared on what we traditionally call, you know, a currency note today, a bill. So Senator Shaheen, who was also the first person to be elected a governor, first woman, I should say, to be elected a governor and senator from one state, she has championed the cause of a group called Women on 20s, which wants to see a woman on the $20 bill by 2020, which would be the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, giving them the right to vote, of course. So there's a couple of good candidates out there. This Women on the 20s, they ran an online poll, and people could submit their favorite choices in it. Four of them emerged so far. So we've got former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, escaped slave and abolitionist Harriet Tubman, civil rights icon and pioneer Rosa Parks, and then the former chief of the Cherokee Nation, Wilma Mankiller. In the first week alone of this poll, this will give you a sense of the interest. More than 230,000 people voted online to try and get a woman on the $20 bill. As we also know, they redesign money every once in a while. Just about every decade, they redesign it to try and thwart counterfeiters.
Mm-hmm.
Last time, the 20 with Andrew Jackson, last time that was rehabbed was 2003. So it's about due.
And Andrew Jackson, if you had to pick somebody to remove from one of our currency, Andrew Jackson would be the easiest target, I think. His legacy is perhaps not what it once was. He was unfriendly to Native Americans at the very least, and he was famous as being sort of the people's president and bringing people into the White House after sort of some stuffy predecessors. But perhaps that doesn't resonate a century later. So and in Nashua, the girls, I believe they voted for Rosa Parks, which would be certainly a good and desirable choice. So do you think this is, you know, I don't know, a novelty act, or does it seem like it's really going to go somewhere?
Well, I don't know. In a speech last year in Missouri, the president himself said he thought it was a pretty good idea to consider it. So when you start to look at the groundswell, maybe by 2020 there's –
Hard to know. I Senator Sheehan has introduced it's literally Senate Bill 925, the Women on the 20 Act, and I think she's actively soliciting co-sponsors, including Kelly Ayotte. I'm sure there's probably a Friends of Andrew Jackson Society somewhere in the country that's going to be very unhappy about this. But who knows? We'll see. It's a very interesting idea. The kind of coordinating it with the 100th anniversary of suffrage is a pretty compelling idea as well. And there's certainly lots of good candidates if they decide to do it.
Well,
yeah,
Senator Sheehan also notes that, of course, we all remember the Susan B. Anthony dollar coins back in the late 70s, early 80s. That was a lifetime ago in terms of media and social media. Now you've got much – this gets to your question of whether it's got staying power, David. And certainly if you've got social media involved and you can drum up a lot of loud support, maybe it stands a better chance.
Of course, the Susan B. Anthony dollar was – not exactly a success. Now, that's not because there was a woman on it. That's because just our attempts to go to dollar coins have been pretty much disastrous forever. But I wonder if that kind of taints the whole idea. Oh, here we go again, if there's anybody who might turn against it because of that. So it's hard to know. And are you surprised that Senator Sheehan has taken this issue up? I mean, do you think this is a part of, well, I don't know, gender politics, at the risk of using a loaded term?
Yeah, certainly. I'm not surprised that she did. As Rick points out, New Hampshire is kind of an appropriate place for this kind of campaign to start. Women in New Hampshire politics have risen to pretty high political roles in this state until – Frank Ginto won re-election. We had an all-female delegation in Washington. We've had we were the first state in the country to have a majority women membership in the legislature and the state senate. So a few years ago, we've had at the same time a woman governor, a woman speaker, a woman senate president, and certainly Senator Sheehan has been a strong supporter of women's rights, reproductive rights.
So this fits in well with her.
It does. And parenthetically, a reelected senator, now someone who really doesn't have to worry about her image for six more years.
More conversation about the week's news coming up. Join us with your thoughts. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm David Brooks of the Nashua Telegraph and GraniteGeek.org, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. And we are going to charge into a topic that I find fascinating, which is solar power, because this week, Solar City, which is the nation's largest installer of residential solar panels and also the biggest advocate of sort of leasing them as compared to selling them, said it was coming in. In fact, it started doing business on Wednesday in New Hampshire. And Dean, is this a really big deal, or is it just kind of like another business tweak?
No, I think it's a reasonably big deal. You know, the rap on solar energy has traditionally been that it's not cost effective, it's too expensive to set up. It requires that companies that produce solar panels and solar for the residential and commercial market need a lot of federal subsidies. They have not figured out how to make it cost effective yet. That seems to be changing slowly. I think the cost has dropped a little bit. This company, Solar City, it's a big one, as you mentioned. They got 7,000 employees in 17 states, including Massachusetts. Just sort of as an aside, its biggest investor is Elon Musk of Tesla Motors and SpaceX, someone who's been very interested in a lot of these alternative sources of energy. I think the biggest innovation here, as you mentioned, is this idea of leasing, the different kinds of leasing and purchasing options you have with this company, that they take on more of the initial cost of installing the rooftop panels, and then you can sell them back additional energy, and there's sort of various contractual ways to make sure that it's cost effective for you as someone who switches from regular sources of energy to solar. And we've had issues here in the state so far with alternative energy. The wind projects have had a difficulty getting off the ground. Solar has kind of been viewed as not cost effective. So, yeah, I think this is definitely a move forward for the industry. It does finally seem to be picking up a little bit.
I would actually say I think the leasing and the purchase power agreement model is what makes the difference with these guys, is sure. that you can go in for $0. I mean, it's like leasing a car as compared to buying one. You don't need to scrape together $10,000 and apply for tax credits and, you know, and realize your power bills are lower and over time you'll get it back. You can go right from the start. And in other parts of the country, that has been a real driver in residential rooftop solar installation, sometimes to the point where the utilities in places – Hawaii is obviously the model, but Arizona, they're fighting about it as well, to the point where the utilities actually are having some issues with it. Rick?
Yeah, I'll be curious to see how it fits in with this sort of all-of-the-above energy strategy that people talk about. We all recognize New England particularly pays – some of the highest rates, if not the highest rates in the country for energy, for a lot of different reasons. We're at the end of the pipeline, so to speak. But no matter where and when these projects are proposed, there's going to be pushback. Whether it's wind or solar or a gas pipeline or electric transmission lines through the White Mountains, there's going to be pushback. So I'll be interested to see how much traction the company can get at this. Now, granted, this is not a huge wind or a solar farm. It's a spottier proposal, but I'd be interested to see what the reaction is.
I think that's key. Is it's distributed? You know, that's the term I like to use. Distributed energy. So it's your home energy. It fits well into the New Hampshire, you know, live for your die model. I want to generate my own electrons instead of having to buy them from the big guy. So that's the argument. It is one of the issues for utilities is that these panels are what they call behind the meter, in that so you're generating electricity, but the utility doesn't know that you are. Because it's on your side of the meter instead of their side of the meter, so it makes it a little hard for them to plan. So you know, the sun goes behind a cloud, and all of a sudden you're going to need more electrons from them, and the sun comes back out again. You need less electrons, and that can push them when you get to a certainly high percentage. New Hampshire has a pretty low rate at the moment of solar power, so it's not a problem at all for Eversource, but it could be. And if I may just – one wonky tidbit I noticed talking about this is the estimate for the total amount of solar power in New England, not New Hampshire but in New England, is 900 megawatts, which is far more than the output of Vermont Yankee. Now, solar power isn't 24/7 like a nuclear power plant is, so you can't always compare that. But still, it showed that solar power has become – more than a niche player, at least, in New England, and perhaps it could be in New Hampshire. So I'd be interested to watch this one. Another extremely interesting and topic that gets a lot of debate for a long time has been the question of how do you pay for rescuing hikers in the White Mountains? And speaking as somebody who likes to hike in the Whites, I think this is a really important and interesting issue. And this week, the state Supreme Court upheld a roughly $9,300 fine or charge against a hiker who was rescued a couple of years ago, back in 2012. Kevin, what do you know about this?
Yeah, the interesting decision, certainly. The Fish and Game Department, the state of New Hampshire, is real happy with this one. The hiker, obviously, Edward Bacon of Michigan, is not. He's indicated he wouldn't return to the state of New Hampshire and retire here if the decision went against him. You know, all things being equal, we've had this law for about 7 years on the books with regards to being able – giving Fish and Game Department and law enforcement authorities the ability to recover these monies from people who are negligent on the mountains or in the woods. And we've had only 63 cases, which – if you think about it, it isn't all that many when you have tens of thousands of hikers here in the state every year.
Rick?
So for some background, so Edward Bacon was he's 62 now. He's hiking here in September 2012. He's on a five-day solo hike in the mountains. He had also had four previous hip dislocations, was under medical care. These are arguments that the state brought up during the trial period. He says his doctor didn't give him any restrictions on what he could do and that he had trained adequately at his home and at a park in Michigan.
Right.
Now,
all those mountains in Michigan.
Well, and that's what the state said. Look, right. You were climbing a 250-foot hill. Now, we spoke with Edward Bacon yesterday from Michigan. He said, I wasn't climbing it once and then traveling to New Hampshire. I climbed it several times. So he hurts himself on the mountain in September 2012. And it took some 15 hours, and I think 30 personnel to get him out. at a cost of a little more than $9,000. This might even be sort of an inexpensive rescue too, because don't forget some of these rescues up in the whites, when you start talking about a helicopter. Or other assets and resources, they can really run into a lot of money. So now the state has got this Hike Safe program, mm-hmm. which essentially you pay $25 for a card, and if you get stuck up there and they say maybe you shouldn't have been there, you're immune from that from having to pay for the rescue.
And I guess the issue is this idea of negligence, right? So it's not simply that he had an emergency on the mountain. It's the discussion was over whether or not he was negligent given his prior history with the artificial hip and the dislocations. Should he have been hiking solo for 5 days on his own? And apparently he jumped some sort of ravine or something and dislocated his hip again. So they viewed that as being negligent.
We have some Facebook comments that, once again, sort of cover the gamut. And so Ariane said, don't people normally have to pay for rescue efforts such as ambulances in non-hiking related emergencies? And I have trouble seeing how this is any different. But on the other hand, Carrie said this ought to discourage others from visiting New Hampshire. With the loss of hiking, mountain climbing, it's only going to hurt tourism. Skiers, take note. Better states to give your business to. And finally, a comment from Thomas, and this is a very common comment, and Fish and Game obviously said that. Is Thomas wrote that before cell phones and other technology, you'd be dead. $9,300 seems a small price for the luxury of being alive. The idea being that people are taking risks because they know they can always call 911. And you got a pretty decent signal even up there on Mount Jefferson. It's amazing. So, all right. Another issue that has been drawn a lot of attention for a while is Pumpkin Fest, of course. There were all the issues that they had in Keene, and Keene decided not to host it once again. So Laconia said, we will. And there was an interesting little twist this week about that from one particular businessman in Keene who was slightly irritated by this. Dean, what do you know about
this? Yeah, as we know, the Pumpkin Fest had been in Keene for 24 years. This next year would have been the 25th anniversary. As we now know, it's going to Laconia. Laconia argued that they have all this experience with Motorcycle Week, so where you have several hundred thousand people for a week. So having a decent crowd for one day is something that they can handle. And so there was this sort of public announcement, and town officials seemed quite thrilled to have the Pumpkin Fest coming to Laconia. And this keen businessman that you mentioned,
Toby Towsley?
Towsley, I assume, but yes.
Property management guy.
Yes. Was unhappy and with basically he didn't like the idea that Laconia would now get the 25th anniversary. They were calling it New Hampshire's Pumpkin Festival. So he went online, I believe, and for $52 a pop, he registered a couple of different names: Annual Pumpkin Festival, New Hampshire Pumpkin Festival. Basically, he wants Laconia to say that it's their first annual Laconia Pumpkin Festival, and not have that added pop of it being the 25th anniversary. So, we'll see where this goes. I know the Claremont's going to have a festival too, and they've registered theirs is going to be it's going to have a different name. I can't recall at the moment, but. They've got their own thing going on as well. New England's Pumpkin Festival.
New England.
So Claremont's going to be New England. Laconia was supposed to be New Hampshire, but now this businessman had said, well, no, Laconia should just be Laconia.
Dean, you mentioned the Claremont Festival, the organizer of Pumpkin Festival, Ruth Sterling. She's done it forever, had done it forever in Keene, and she was up in Laconia last week for the announcement. And what she wants to do, she's reaching out to those other festivals saying, go ahead, have your festival. We love it. It's a great idea. And then preserve your pumpkins. Refrigerate them, cart them up here. We'll have the biggest, baddest pumpkin festival ever, and we'll set a new record. So it's interesting that she really – it seems anyway that she truly wants to make it a New Hampshire Pumpkin Festival, not just a specific location.
Well, I'd like to give a little comment here to what I think is the best pumpkin festival in the state, which is Goffstown. They have one where the giant pumpkins come down, as we know, and they carve them out, and people get in them with little electric motors, and they dress up, the vice principal and the police chief and all that, put on goofy clothes, and they zip around there in that little lake there in the center of town and squirt each other, and people stand on the bridge and pour water on them, and it is great. And you would be surprised, by the way, a giant pumpkin makes an excellent boat as long as you've got the ballast right. So just as a thought there. So I don't know where you could do it. I Nashua could do it on the Merrimack River, except then they'd all end up floating down to Lowell, and I guess it probably wouldn't work too well. So all right. By the way, so it does look like the Laconia Pumpkin Festival is definitely going forward. Is that correct?
Yes.
But it is a one-year agreement, if I'm not mistaken, right? I mean, and that's one of the real questions here is that and certainly Mr. Towsley was trying to make this point that we're not sure it's really going to take hold in Laconia like it did in Keene for so many years. And as we've seen, a number of communities were interested in having this, and they may well take a long look at how well Laconia does, and if they're not pleased with the turnout or the number of pumpkins, try and make their own pitch.
I mean, Laconia's got kind of a different tone than Keene, and I don't know whether that would – I mean, you know, pumpkins, Laconia with the bike festival, obviously you get this idea, and that doesn't seem like – I don't know. Is that an issue? Some people worry that it's gonna I don't know, tweak it somehow?
I don't know, David, if that is an issue. Ruth Sterling and the mayor in Laconia at Engler, they were thrilled to be connected to Charlie St. Clair, the guy who organizes Bike Week up there. So they really think there could be some sympathetic behavior here between the two events, and they could feed off of each other.
I guess Bike Week has gotten a little milder over the years, so it could associate with pumpkins without being too embarrassed, or the pumpkins not being too alarmed, I suppose. So, one last item to talk about. This is unfortunately a little more serious. Of course, the earthquake in Nepal, which we've all heard about, the death total has unfortunately risen well above 6,000, and it looks like it's probably going to go higher. And there have been a lot of people who want to help. And the general comment from everybody is the way to help is to give money. There's no need to send stuff or to try to do things or give blood, anything like that. Send money, but that led to some concerns this week as fears of scams. Anybody know details about the Attorney General actually issued a warning? Is that correct?
Yes, he did. The Attorney General wanted people to be certainly on the lookout for potential scams that, unfortunately, in our society today, and particularly with social media and the internet and robocalls, it's pretty easy for scurrilous people to set up a bogus fundraising effort and try and prey on people's goodwill right now. And there's certainly a lot of people who want to help. The Attorney General's warning essentially said just do your own due diligence about these groups that approach you about raising money. Try and make sure they have a presence on the ground in Nepal or an international presence when it comes to helping victims of disasters such as this. That's your best defense.
It's unfortunate that this has become pretty much standard. Anytime there's a big media disaster, almost faster than the real efforts are out, there's scams out there trying to grab your money, and it's kind of depressing that you have to keep your eye open like that.
Yeah, and certainly as the Attorney General's staff had noted too, what invariably happens is you have these very reputable groups, Doctors Without Borders, the International Red Cross, and these scams kind of develop pseudonyms that sound very much like those organizations. So you get the impression, you know, instead of Doctors Without Borders, it's, you know, Doctors Without Boundaries. And you think, well, I've heard of that group. I'll give to them. They do great work. And it's not. It's a scam.
I know there is a fairly serious hiking community in the state, obviously, that has been organized. And there's also a larger than many people realized community of people from Nepal in New Hampshire. And both of those have organized drives. And those are probably good places to start with if you're uncertain about where to go. So,
yeah, and David, I'll just add, you mentioned the hiking community. There's a very respected guide in Nepal right now. I'm not sure where he is. He was up near base camp when the earthquake struck, that's Rick Wilcox up at International Mountain Equipment, I think,
yep.
North Conway. He's been up there, I think that was his 19th trek to Everest. So we'll hope Rick gets home safely.
Is there any news from him at all? Do we know?
I haven't heard from him since I spoke. I have not heard from him at all. His staff I talked to earlier in the week.
Right.
They know he's safe.
They know he's safe. Okay, excellent. All right, great. Well, next week on The Exchange, we're going to look at whether New Hampshire is prepared for its quickly aging population. We'll also check in with political junkie Ken Rudin about the latest national political headlines. That's some of what we're up to next week. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm David Brooks with the Nashua Telegraph, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. Thanks for listening.